And welcome. You are listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM, one of our wonderful community radio partners internationally, or our podcast, which will be back to its extended format today. We have a lot to get to today. I have an absolutely packed house full of people. We are welcoming some new volunteers on this episode. There's been a very, very busy news week. We have all sorts of pipelines, court decisions, global trade agreements, all sorts of things going on. It's a very busy week. So because of that, I would like to get right to our first interview as well. So we're going to get right down to business. We're going to be talking to Jeff Douglas from Rennebach today. And if I'm not mistaken, I already have him on the line. Are you there, Jeff?
Yes, I'm here, Darren.
All right. Thank you so much for taking some time to join us today. We're going to be talking about your business. So you are the VP of sales for a company called Rennebach, which is at rennebach.com. And we were interested in talking to you because... Well, I mean, frankly, this to me, just to start right out of the gate, this sounds like one of those businesses that was, it's a great idea because it's obvious, but apparently nobody thought of it.
you're quite right. And it was, you know, back a couple of years ago when some great minds came together. And, of course, the a perfect business model is finding a problem and, more importantly, applying a solution. And, you know, a lot of talk these days, especially following the COP21 with climate change and greenhouse gas emissions. And actually, that ties in really well with our story because Rennebach.com it's an online classified that's specifically targeted at the construction and the renovation business. And what a lot of people don't understand is that just here in Canada alone, we've got over 25 million tons of solid waste that's being tipped into our landfills on the outskirts of town, and out of that, about 35% of that comes from the construction and renovation business. We're trying to do something about that.
Yeah, I see here in one of the stories I was looking at, that's 25 million tons of solid waste dumped into landfill. And one of the things that you talk about is that a lot of this isn't even, you know, used. It's part of it is, you know, getting people to get out of this mindset of, you know, everything has to be new. But frankly, a whole bunch of this stuff is new.
Well, you're absolutely right. You know, we try to drive awareness through mainstream media, doing presentations like this one. Thank you very much. And also through our social media and trying to make people aware that we've got to change the way that that we've thought about things in the past. And we look at our site and about 50% of the materials coming onto our site are new materials. Now these are either retailers that that are viewing our site now as a liquidation site, so they can get rid of. Just get rid of excess materials, overstocked materials, perhaps stale dated materials. But at the same time, we get contractors and builders that they maybe have missized doors, missized windows, and unfortunately for them, it's just easier to toss all of that into a bin and dump it on the outskirts of town. So actually, we do have almost half of the material on our site is new material, and a lot of that stuff would have been destined to a landfill.
So let's get into some specifics. What type of materials are we talking about? Are we like little pieces here or you know, entire houses? Or give me some specifics on what we're talking about.
Well, we can go all the way from the steel barn that a property owner down in Okotoks, down south of Calgary, back a few months ago. He had a steel barn, 5,000 square foot. The building was only about 6 years old. And he didn't want to dump it. He said, you know, this is a brand new building. He was having it replaced with a fairly new building, sorry. He was having it replaced with a larger structure, and the contractor that was putting in the new structure just thought it was easiest to scrap the old building. And he thought, no, there's got to be a better solution than that. And, I mean, aside from the fact that you're tossing away something that's perfectly reusable, there was the environmental impact as well, and he gave that a lot of thought. He'd actually tried some of the other classifieds, posted it in the paper, and had no interest. And he posted it on our site, and we were quite surprised to see a barn being posted on our building for free. If you could take it away, you can have it. And anyway, he posted it on there, and it was about 24 hours it took to secure an interested party, and they had to bring a team in to naturally to take it down. But it goes all the way from that. We've got all types of building materials, kitchen products. Unfortunately, when a lot of people do kitchen renovations, it's just easier to throw away the kitchen cabinets and countertops and sinks and all of that stuff just gets dumped. And so we make it really easy for them. If homeowners are doing a home renovation, they can ahead of time they can come in and post this stuff on our site. We have a very active audience that's looking for this stuff. We had a woman recently. Global News did a story on her out here in Calgary, who had redone her basement, and she made it her mission to shop on our site for all of the materials. And she did pick up a lot of new materials, but. She figured that she saved about $10,000 on the finishing of her basement by picking up all of the necessary items off of our site.
Yeah, and I saw that story, and I thought that was very interesting. There was one other detail though that I think got my attention more than that number, because saving $10,000, it's a big number. It sounds very impressive, but in the back of my head, I'm just sort of naturally skeptical. In the back of my head, I was like, well, okay, my brother, for instance, works in the construction business. And renovations are expensive. So who knows? I mean, if you're talking about a $2 million renovation, $10,000, maybe that's minimally just for people that really want to do their best. But maybe on a big scale, that's not really. No, that was over half of her cost.
Yeah,
that's really incredible.
Yeah, well, that was a good story, and we like to get a lot of mileage out of it. But that's not the only story that we have. We've got we get a lot of positive feedback, and we measure the traffic going through the site. We get comments coming back to us, and people are catching on. Now, our story is primarily here in Alberta. We are based in Calgary. And our story is catching on pretty quickly across Alberta, and now to the west out to Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. But we've recently expanded our reach into Toronto and the GTA, and our story is picking up a lot of momentum there. And we're actually focusing our attention now on your region, and you'll be hearing a lot more about us over the next couple of months.
So, Jeff, I don't want to take us either of us too far outside of our expertise, but let's speculate a little bit on the psychology of this. So, I think you would agree that there's definitely a bit of an attitude that people are sort of preemptively biased against this type of behavior. We're to some degree maybe conditioned, you might say, that that if you're getting something that isn't sort of brand new out of the store, that there's sort of inherent assumption that you're getting a worse product. Can you comment on the validity of the truth of that? So what may be some sort of concessions somebody might have to make, if any, by using the types of materials off your site, and then also just the mentality behind it?
Well, that's a good question, Darren. And getting back to what I said earlier about the COP21, we're all about trying to. We make all these attempts to change people's thoughts on reusing materials, and the materials that we see on our site again, used cabinets and used countertops. There really is nothing wrong with those. Those are perfectly reusable, and we have people coming on our site and giving these materials away for free, because even they understand that tipping these into the landfills, aside from the environmental impact, that there's a cost associated with that, because it has to be transported to the site, and it has to be paid to be dumped. So, anyway, getting back to your question, I think more and more people are becoming receptive to the idea of at least considering reusing materials that have previously been used. You find that a lot of these older materials are better quality than what you might pick up at a box store, and people are starting to catch on and recognize that, hey, you know what? If I can save myself 50 or 60% or more on this home renovation product, I should reconsider, going out and paying top retail for something new that probably may not last as long. And anyway, we find that more and more people are looking at the environmental and the social issues and becoming much more receptive to at least considering. And when they come to our site, they see these new materials, or they see used materials that are comparable to new, and they're getting them at considerable savings.
Yeah. And that's kind of the angle that I'm really interested in, because, you know, there's no way to put all quote unquote environmentalists into one box. There's a wide range of opinion on all issues for people that identify as, you know, being concerned about those types of issues. But I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you know, I think there's really something to be said, and we try here on this program to, you know, promote the values and the ethics and the kind of practicality of it as well. But I mean, at the end of the day, a lot of the time what we're talking about is that a huge portion, a gigantic proportion, potentially over half of the portion of environmental value really here is efficiency. And efficiency in almost all cases directly translates to a dollar savings. And if really what it takes to get people to start thinking about, you know, reusing materials and being more efficient and being more eco-friendly is that we show them how much money they can save, I'm okay with that personally. I don't know about you.
No, that's well, our slogan, when you go on the site, you'll see our slogan is Save Green. And it has a dual meaning. Here in Alberta, I think, things have gone a little wanky here with oil tipping down below $29 now, or below $30. And, you know, here the emphasis is on saving money. But when we look out on the West Coast, the emphasis is on saving the environment, and they've got some very aggressive zero net waste mandates, very supportive of the circular economy, and Vancouver is striving to be the greenest city in the world by the year 2020. They actually called us up and asked us if we would extend our reach out to their neighborhood, because they want all of the resources available to help them to achieve that mandate. So whether you're saving green, whether you're saving money, or whether you're saving the environment, you're actually being environmentally responsible by saving money by shopping on a site like Renovac.com.
All right. So if you're just tuning in now, we're talking to Jeff Douglas, who's the VP of sales there at Renovac.com. And it's about saving money and saving the environment at the same time by simply not wasting the absolutely abhorrent amount of waste that goes in that is usually associated with construction. Of course, any major urban city right now in Canada, but I mean, just generally speaking, there's tons and tons of construction going on. So this is both a huge problem and a huge opportunity. We are unfortunately, however, really tight on time today. So I only have time to ask you one more question, Jeff. And I always like to sort of end on a bit of a 10,000 feet sort of level. So I mean, your business here is doing well, and it's achieving sort of both of those sort of dual goals, as you said there, at the same time. Can I ask you to comment on, you know, sort of business trends and attitudes here? Are we witnessing here, and do you feel that you are sort of part of a new wave of sort of rethinking the types of business opportunities that are good? Is this indicative of a change in sort of attitude in generally? Or do you think that maybe we still got some work to do, but you just sort of capitalized on one of these good ideas? Is this beginning of a trend or not, basically?
That's a good question, Darren. I just got back from Toronto, and I had a meeting there with had several meetings there. We've had a dynamic response from contractors that specialize in the renovation space in the city of Toronto and the GTA. And they all look at our model, and they all listen to our story, and they all say, you know what, this is the trend that's here to stay, and it's actually being mandated by a lot of municipalities now across the country. So contractors, home builders, renovators, they're being mandated to minimize their waste. And again, they've got to look for alternatives. So people are being forced to make these adjustments to their old business models, and they're looking at they're looking for solutions, and that's why they're so receptive and grateful that you know, Renovac is here. If you want to buy a car, if you want to buy concert tickets, don't come to Renovac, because that's not what we do. we only address a very specific market, and people are coming to our site and they're looking for these materials because they're embracing change. And if we don't embrace and change and adapt to new ideas, get rid of that old habits of ours, you know, all this these issues about climate change, it's not going to go away. It's only going to get worse. So we're hoping to make a difference. That's our mandate that drives us. Our legacy is that you know, we want to make the world just a little better place, and make life a little more pleasant for everybody, because we don't have another world to go to. This is it.
I think that's a great place to end because I couldn't agree more. Thank you so much for your time, Jeff Douglas.
Thank you, Darren.
All right. So if anyone was interested as well, Renoback is spelled exactly how it sounds, but you can also get that off our website. We'll have some links there. And Jeff, being a sales guy, I'm sure we'll have every interest in talking to you if you have any further questions for him. So don't hesitate to reach out to him as well. We're going to go to our first music break now here in just a minute. We'll come back and get some very busy news discussion underway here on the Green Majority at CIUT 89.5 FM or one of our wonderful partners or on the podcast. You can learn more if you need to at greenmajority.com. We'll be right back. We are back here on the Green Majority. I also have the pleasure today, we're introducing a lot of new people these days, and right now I have the pleasure to introduce our new tech. Alex, is it Ricci?
Yep, that's
Alex, right. Ricci is joining us today, first go. Doing a great job so far.
Thanks.
And I was wondering if you could tell us what we were just listening to.
Yeah, that was a cover of a David Bowie song, 5 Years, by a Canadian artist, Mo Kenny. We're trying to keep the CRTC happy. So yeah, that was Mo Kenny, an artist out of Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, covering David Bowie, 5 Years.
All right. So we're coming back to some news. It's been a very, very busy news week so far. And one of the things I got confused about a little bit when I was even reading through it was there was so much sort of court decision news this week that I fully got lost on which one was which. So I had to review everything this morning just to keep it all straight. But I'm hoping that, Stefan, you decided a way to go through this that was going to make sense of it for me. So why don't I leave to you on this?
For sure. So basically what we're looking at is sort of the importance of precedent. Legal precedent specifically, at least on today's show. And we're going to go through a couple different – we're going to flow through all the different legal precedents that may have been set and may be set soon. Beginning with the most important one in my argument, which is that the BC Supreme Court has ruled that the province, quote, has breached the honor of the Crown by failing to consult with the Gitka at?
Gitkat.
All right. And other coastal First Nations on the Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline. And so that obviously is huge news. It comes on the heels, actually, of BC also formally coming out and actually opposing the pipeline as a direct opposition, which is a little bit, I don't know, hypocritical, given that they also waived the right to run their own, own environmental assessment. Someone in late further down in the article is quoted as saying, basically, they're like, "Yeah, the federal government, we oppose this, but we'll let the federal government decide rather than actually, you know, just making the decision, you know, for the people of BC." But
And furthermore, and sorry, I don't know if you're getting to this, but the furthermore on that was the idea too that they were in addition to that were also basically saying we might appeal this. We're still against it, but we might appeal our right to the right we've been given to make our own decision.
Yeah,
I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, lots happened. But what's important here actually is first to understand what failure to consult means, and MA can speak to that.
Sure. So I think one additional sort of case note on this, just to sort of establish why the ruling went the way it did, was in 2010, the BC Liberals signed what is called an equivalency agreement, which is what effectively handed over these responsibilities to the federal government and the decision-making power that goes with environmental assessments and the duty to consult First Nations. What's really interesting is I think it's fascinating to see what's coming out of BC as a province, because the landmark case which set the duty to consult in our Canadian legal framework actually happened in 2014. It was a case where the Chilcotin First Nation took the BC government to the Supreme Court of Canada for logging rights that they had given away 20 years ago. And what came out of that case was that based on Aboriginal title, even Aboriginal title that is still in the proceeding process and not even finalized is a basis that the government does have the duty to consult First Nations. So that was established as a legal precedent, and we're seeing it now being used as the basis for other really high-profile cases that have very significant environmental implications, like this case, and also like another case that is before the courts in Ontario around Line 9.
Yeah, so let's So let's move to that case to some extent. That, you know, as we're moving forward on sort of the importance of precedence, which is because, again, another failure consult case. And really what needs to be informed is that precedent actually hosts a very is super, super important. Especially in legal terms. In reality, our Constitution doesn't actually have the word environment in it, as a fun fact, and doesn't actually in nowhere does it actually say where the environment goes and different sort of things, or environmental production should be held, and the way that was really decided actually was through precedent, and so case by case, but I cannot sort of overstate the importance of setting a strong precedent and the power of what a precedent can do to shape the future. So if this sort of failure consult precedent is sort of carried on, especially with the second case and as we go forward, you're going to see it a lot and a lot harder for people to sort of trample on First Nations rights. So Emma, you said also looked a bit at the Line 9 case as well.
Yes, so there's also a legal battle over Line 9, which, as I think people are familiar, runs between Sarnia, Ontario, and Montreal. And so this case involves the Chippewas of the Thames First Nation against Enbridge, the National Energy Board, the notorious NEB, and the Attorney General of Canada. And it is also being put forward on the same basis, that there was a failure of a duty to consult First Nations. As we know that Line 9 has been given the go-ahead to do what it's proposed, so this is a legal challenge. It's one of several legal challenges to that. And I think cases like this are really making both private industry and environmentalists alike stand up and pay attention. Now, I'd like to think that environmentalists already have Indigenous rights on the radar. I want to make that assumption, but we know that that hasn't always been the case historically, unfortunately. And what we're seeing is that not only is the duty to consult something that should be there in its own right, as the right of First Nations, but it's also a very strong legal tool around environmental protection. And as we've seen in the last couple of years, cases that involve private industry possibly contravening or doing things that are damaging to the natural world, that are damaging to the communities that run through pipelines, the strongest challenges against these have come actually from First Nations groups. So we are definitely seeing, I'd say, a positive trend in how these are being interpreted by the courts.
Yeah. I want to just stick in sort of two common general comments on this as well. One of them has to do with the First Nations aspect, which is that, you know, from the point of view of somebody that's not, quote unquote, not on our side, as far as understanding that these are things that shouldn't proceed because of the inevitable, you know, buying, you're setting infrastructure for things that we shouldn't be using. And by building them, it sort of means that you're locking in, blah, blah, blah. But from the other point of view, say if you're, you know, either unaware or you have a different assessment of those facts, and I'm trying to be as generous as possible, in that it could be easily be seen to, you know, I could see somebody on that side of either the information side or the ideology side saying, you know, kind of taking the view of like, oh, those troublesome First Nations groups, look, no, nobody else is against it. It's just always First Nation groups that are in court. But you have to understand one really important thing, which is that it seems to be somewhat of a technicality to some degree, but because of all of the legal finagling and the amount of influence that these corporations have, is that, it's really, they're the only people in this country that really have a legal opportunity to do anything about it. And if anybody else could, they would be. And I don't think that's, I think that's an indictment of how much, you know, it might be too far to say corruption, but how much influence, let's say, that industry has, that we don't really have any other recourse. And I think that's, it's an indication of another problem, but it does complicate the matter when you're trying to talk to a wider audience that maybe doesn't have, you know, a comprehensive view of it. The other thing I wanted to point out really quickly before we went was just sort of looking at it from the general public's point of view, is that if you go and you read any one of these individual stories, and as usual, they will all be posted on the website, you'll go and you'll see sort of the side that the First Nations groups are saying, and you'll take the side that the, you know, some quotes from some government people, and you'll take some quotes from the oil companies. And if you only read it, that one article, if you only read any one of them, what you'll see is, you know, everybody seems to be making an argument. Well, we weren't consulted, and the oil companies like, okay, well, we didn't consult you, but this is good. And, you know, this is an annoying, you know, technicality you're making us do. But at the end of the day, this is good for everybody, and stop getting in our way. And one of the things that they like to say all the time, though, is that, you know, you'll see these words, you know, world-class safety and unprecedented, you know, investment in public consultation, all these things. But what you do if you read just even three of them, even if you read just the three that we're going to post today, you'll see that three different people from two different companies about three different pipelines, all say that that pipeline has the world's, you know, best safety and security measures and all these upgraded features and all this stuff. It can't possibly be true. Like, it's just by mutually exclusive, you can't have two things that are the best. So, like, there's just so much sort of rhetoric on behind besides the oil companies. And what really starts to come out of it after you read a few of these things in succession is that really what we're looking at here is just absolute indignation of an industry that is used to absolutely having its way. And for the first time ever, there is getting some support for the people that are saying, no, not on my watch. And just the indignation of having somebody stand up to them is just so impressive. But what I'm concerned about is that people that don't have that full story are really going to take a different view of this. And I mean, A, that's why we do this show, but B, that's also, I think, why this, you know, why people who are informed get these points of view on these issues. And then, you know, you go to the general public or you go to an election and that's not how it sorts out. And it's because if you only look at one tiny slice of this, it's really confusing what's actually true.
Yeah. And I want to get back to the legal precedent piece because we have a third story that also ties in. But before that, I want to make one quick comment on the first thing you mentioned about First Nations being the ones in courts, which is specifically that the only reason they're going to court is because they're the only people who had their rights trampled, so they have to. You know, this is literally a question of whether or not we can build something through their land, and the only responsibility we have is the duty to consult. If Trump Tower was in the middle, if you had to knock down Trump Tower to build Energy East or Northern Gateway, this wouldn't be going to court. It never would have got there because there wouldn't be a conversation. You know, time and time again, treaty rights and First Nations control over their own land is sort of only half counts to our government and to business interests. Whereas if this was, you know, if this was a very rich corporation that owned this land and they were like, no, I'm here, there wouldn't be a conversation about duty to consult because there wouldn't be a conversation at all. You just find a different way.
I don't think we're disagreeing, but to clarify for the audience what I meant by that was that, you know, it's because that the idea of being able to go to the NDB and present evidence that this is dooming us to catastrophic runaway climate change that's going to impoverish all future generations after this, if we don't do about something, is not something that we're allowed to take to court. It's been prevented from being presented. So these are the options we're left with. I just want to be clear for the audience what I meant.
That's a really important point, I think, here, is that there's an absolute lack of confidence, and that's probably a massive understatement, in the National Energy Board. I mean, there are widespread calls to reform this institution, which is actually supposed to be moderating all of this and regulating all of this in the in public interest. And that does include, I would argue, Indigenous rights. Indigenous people are part of the public, and they have legally established rights. But we've seen this institution be completely ineffectual, and now this institution is actually being taken to court. So what does that say about its effectiveness in this regard? So I think this is also a very strong signal and a very positive one that there needs to be massive reform, maybe even more extreme measures when it comes to the NEB.
Yeah. And the last thing before we move on to the next legal precedent conversation is just that the NEB has outwardly stated that it would not accept climate change as an understanding of how to deal with pipelines, which is the reason why no one has any faith in it, because they're basically being like, you know, that thing that everyone cares about, we're going to ignore it when we can make this consideration. But to the third legal precedent So this is kind of a funny story in which 2 days ago we were like, there was a possibility of legal precedent being set, and then yesterday this not. But the story is still interesting and I want to get to it, which was that there's more and more protesters are beginning to use what they call the necessity defense against when they come up and stop different types of fossil fuel extraction or fossil transportation measures. Specifically, the story that came out earlier this week was one of something called the Delta 5, who basically built this kind of tripod over a train station, a train tracks, to block crude oil. And because they were stopped, and the argument basically is that the blockade was necessary to prevent harm to greater good. And the term goes greater good is, you know, not having climate change, runaway climate change. And this argument that's actually been successfully used in the UK, but this was going to be the first time it was going to be used in the United States that went to jury. And there's two points about that I want to point. First is, it turned out 2 days later, the judge actually at the very end, last second, said, actually, don't let them use that defense, jury. Don't consider necessity defense as acceptable. So never mind. This is not the first use of that going to a jury. But the other thing is that a year ago, Darren, you and I, talking about before, and we remember this conversation we had about In actually, in funny enough, in our least watched video ever, when I went back
did
to
you check it? Actually,
six people watched this video.
Oh, the world, four plus you and me.
Exactly, exactly. Thank you, four people. But it was another use of the necessity defense within the United States. But the reason why it didn't set any precedent is because it was actually it never went to court. A governor general, I believe, came out and basically said, you know what? I'm going to accept this argument and drop the charges. He not so much dropped the charges. He actually he just freed them. He was like, I accept this argument, and so you're absolved. Which is interesting because given the fact that this is actually a piece of it, you know, this never it's kind of good and bad because if it actually had gone to court and set a precedent, we'd be in a lot better place than we are right now. But at the same time, it is proof that there are people out there who are actually willing to take this and pay attention to it. So again, we posted that other article about it. It was actually a blockade. It was a couple of guys in a lobster boat actually in front of a gigantic coal mine.
You know what? We'll post the old video on it. Maybe we can get the watchers up to 10.
Oh, that'd be so great. Yeah.
If four more people
it'd make all our efforts a year and a half ago really valuable.
Yeah. but I don't think it's an accident as well. Like we can't know what's in the mind of that judge, but my opinion would be was that it's very likely that this judge also took that into account and said I this is right in this case, but I'm not interested in setting the precedent that's going to cause a chain reaction of legal hysteria for the next 10 years trying to sort out what this precedent means. So I think it's the best for all parties involved that we don't make that we solve this in a fair way that doesn't set precedent. I think that was intentional, but that's just my opinion.
Not opening the floodgates is what it sounds like.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, yeah, because that's the thing. If there's ever actually if there's a strong precedent set for the necessity defense can be successfully used against energy infrastructure, especially fossil infrastructure, it would cause massive disruption.
I would say that would be arguably as world changing as the internet, and that's a strong statement. But I mean, really, I mean, if you think about like every person that cares about this issue now essentially be getting a get out of jail free card to go and disrupt an industry they don't like, I don't even think that's necessarily a good thing. I would think it would have to be under very specific confines, because just a carte blanche to, you know, you can prove that they're doing something that could potentially or very likely could harm future generations gives you a get out of jail free card to basically do what you want. I think that's a terrible idea.
You need to very quickly ramp up some sort of, well, you need to switch to a clean energy future very, very quickly.
Yeah. That's what I mean. I mean, the implications of that would be enormous.
I think you'd have to demonstrate without a doubt that you had followed every other recourse available to you.
Yeah.
And that this was really the only recourse left.
It was necessary.
It was
maybe
necessary.
As a way to tie this that conversation actually back to Canada and to pipelines, I was having you and I were actually sitting around CSI a couple days ago. And discussing the Line 9 protests that are going on, where people sort of show up and just turn off the valve, and how it seems as if there's been a somewhat of an exodus of the major sort of environmental nonprofits switching their interests into Energy East and Northern Gateway, and sort of have accepted that Line 9's, you know, basically done, and that we sort of lost that battle, move on to some extent. And yet there are these sort of pockets of people, who are just sort of shutting down, valves. It sounds as if they actually show up, tell the people who run Line 9 they're going to shut it down, tell them to do it from their end so it's much safer. They do it, and they don't actually have to turn it off to ensure that, that no actual oil is spilled. But they're still doing something that's dramatic, and that's the kind of thing that, they're arrested and they need to – what are they going to do? Probably make the necessity defense. And then that connects directly to the sort of fact that we don't have this precedent to protect treaty rights, which is currently going through the courts in Ontario as well.
Mm. So we're getting close to where we could take a break. We've got a couple other things. Do you guys want to leave the NAFTA? Because I want to get to the NAFTA angle. Do you want to do that quickly now, or should we do that?
Let's do that after the break. I think that merits some thoughtful consideration.
All right, yeah. I think I'm a little hyper today, I got to be honest with you. So, let's all take a break. Let's do another quick music break here. Alex, do you want to tell us ahead of time this time what we're going to listen to?
Yes, I do. this is Merchant Copy with a song called Patriotic, and it's actually one of our host MA's brothers.
Yes,
band.
That's right.
Yeah.
I'm proud of that, too.
All right, so let's hear it.
All right, that's a good question. That's something I think about every morning, actually. Shout out to Emmy's. What's your brother's name?
It's Enlai.
Enlai, thanks for the song. That was great. So also, if you have a friend or family member or also a musician and would like to have your music considered, feel free to send it to us. That sounded silly. I was actually being serious.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know
that
why
was a real thing.
I don't know why I made suggestion. That sound like
we
that.
Support homegrown talent here.
And, there we
you know,
do.
I just want to say the reason why I like that song and I recommended that it be played on the show is that it's a new year. Canada's starting out with a new government. Our parliamentarians are going to go sit in the House at the end of January. So I'd just like Canada to do some reflecting on what kind of nation we want to be this year and going forward from there.
Awesome. So in case you're just tuning in or if you dozed off there for a minute, you are listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. You could be listening perhaps on one of our internationally syndicated community radio partners, who we love, by the way. They're very awesome.
They're
and
lovely.
We very appreciate them. They're great. And then also our podcast audience, which will be treated once again to a after show. If you're on the podcast today, we'll be doing a brief wrap up because, as usual, we always run out of time with about things to talk about. But on that note, we'll also get right back to it. So, Emma, you're going to lead us in a little bit of a conversation, which is sort of a follow up comment on a discussion we had last week, which is about trade agreements and specifically NAFTA. So,
we're picking up the trade agreement thread, which I think we are going to be continuing to do throughout this year. What I think will be really interesting is when we start to see the legal cases around the duty to consult intersect with the legal challenges around our trade agreements. So I say, Canada, look out for that. We're seeing progressive decisions being taken with regards to First Nations legal cases, but we're also seeing our government sign up to increasingly more restrictive trade agreements. So those two things are going to come into collision. That's what I predict. Anyways, onward with this one case that we wanted to just briefly discuss because it does highlight some potential important legal aspects to the ongoing sort of litigation around trade agreements. Is that there's this company that was formerly known as Abitibi Bowater, now renamed as Resolute Forest Products, which has been quite successful, actually, in posing legal challenges to the Canadian government. They've already had a settlement of about $130 million, as I understand it. In this case, they're taking the Nova Scotian government to court. In a nutshell, what this case is about is that they opened up a sawmill in Quebec, and they had to close it down, citing losses. And they're attributing a lot of those losses to the fact that another sawmill, which employs about 1,000 people in Cape Breton, is subsidized by the Nova Scotia government. And so this is their basis for suing the Canadian government under NAFTA. And what this case highlights is two important things. One, that there's a loophole in NAFTA where companies that have sort of most of their resources, most of their holdings in Canada can actually register as an American company and then come in through the back door, so to speak, and use the investor state dispute resolution settlement mechanism in NAFTA to sue the Canadian government under the guise, I would say, of being a U.S. company. The other part of this is that we haven't seen a lot of challenges being based on subsidies. That is a tool that provincial governments and other levels of government are able to use to, you know, incentivize local growth and industry, employment, that kind of thing. But this case could potentially, if it does go in the favor of this company, really create a chill on provincial governments using subsidies to motivate local development and employment, as is the case here. So thought that was worth flagging up. We were talking about the legal challenge to the United States posed by TransCanada under NAFTA last week. However, there is a difference here in track record. Apparently, Canada is the quote-unquote developed country that's been sued the most under trade agreements, and the United States has yet to lose one. And we've had 5 environmental-related challenges under NAFTA to date, so I just wanted to flag that up.
Mm. And I apologize. I missed if you said this. I didn't hear you say give a number, but just to give a sort of context on the amount of money we're talking about, these are usually in the over $100 million type
range. Yeah.
So we're not talking about pocket change here. And I also wanted to
change.
Yeah, it's several pockets worth of money. And the other thing I wanted to point out as well, because as you said, the terminology that's used in the legal context is investor state dispute resolution something blah blah blah. Just to sort of put a fine point on this, what that means in common language, that means your laws cost me money, or your laws could cost me money in the future. And it's a pathway by which we defer sovereignty to profit, which in some contexts, you could make an argument for. But when we're talking about multinational corporations, in one case, being able to play countries off the other, or as MA just perfectly outlined, a company going and getting a mailbox in the US and then using it as a backdoor, essentially just as a scheme to rip money out of the system. It's a scheme. It's a scam.
And this is actually this is just ripping up to the be taxpayers. A good basis to make profit, isn't it?
Yeah, it's,
you can get $100 million plus as a settlement for industry that was unsuccessful. I mean, these are industries often that are claiming bankruptcy. This is actually a really good profit-making scheme.
Yeah. And we want to move on because we're obviously tight on time, as I keep saying. But one other thing I want to draw people's attention to that I think they may be familiar with is that there's an entire cottage industry. I don't know if that's the right word. I just like that expression. There's an entire cottage industry around suing people for copyrights. So, for instance, there's entire companies that are worth millions of dollars that all they do is essentially copy other people's stuff that they didn't properly copyright, and then sue the people who actually made it for copyright infringement because they were the first person to do it. Sorry, it's patent law. And there's giant holes in the U.S., and John Oliver did a great piece on this. But there's an entire industry based around abusing patent laws. This is the exact tape type thing. This is not legitimate business practices or a fair way to settle reasonable disputes. What we're talking about is people gaming the system and ripping off taxpayers. And everybody, it doesn't matter where you sit on the political spectrum, should be upset about that. But we'll leave it there, I think, for now. Stefan.
Yeah. So on a little lighter note, and actually, a note that everyone does agree on this as a fun fact.
Ooh.
I want to flag. So about a news story about the new Ontario Environment Commissioner. And don't worry, it's not really Ontario centric. It's more just about some of the ideas she's putting forward. It's a very interesting article in the National Post in which they call her radical, which, of course, anyone who has ideas that we'd agree with probably called radical. But at the same time, it was interesting. While being called radical, she was still the consensus choice of all three parties. So the Conservative Party of Ontario, which had Tim Hudak as their previous leader, who wanted to cut literally 100,000 jobs from public service, was also like, yes, Diane Sachs is the person I want being an Ontario's environmental commissioner, which I think should speak to sort of her credentials, I'd argue. She was a 40-year career as environmental lawyer. But what interested me in the article, some of her ideas are really things that, you know, we've been people saying forever. A great quote from her is, fossil fuel subsidies do not reduce inequality, they increase inequality, because most of the money goes to the better off. And and that's an interesting point, given the fact that the most common argument against ending fossil fuel subsidies is this idea that, well, then how are the people who really, really need gas and stuff like that going to be able to afford it? We're actually reducing the price. And we've done a whole video about how that doesn't actually work and all this sort of stuff.
But the short version is, the real answer was, it's helping some people who need help, and it's disproportionately helping people who don't. So we take it away, and then we can always just because you take something away doesn't mean you can't add something. We can take it away and then add something that's more specifically geared to make sure that just the people that actually need help get it.
Well,
it's not that complicated.
Well, and not only that, it's also often a drop in the bucket. You're giving it to the people producing it rather than the people, it's not a direct subsidy. We're not giving people money to it. And any sort of subsidy of that nature that's not sort of targeted is going to be inherently biased towards people who buy more of it, which obviously are richer people. But the quote I want to bring, which is really just a thing to think about, we can talk about it if you like, but as far as I just want to throw this thought out there, because I just love it so much, is that she's quoted later on in the article saying, land use planning and development is really Ontario's oil sands. It's our biggest factor driving greenhouse gas emissions. It's tied very strongly to important parts of the economy, and it has long-lasting important impacts. And I think the concept of just connecting land use, and land use, of course, is a super hot topic in Ontario, given the fact that we have some of the most fertile agricultural land in the entire world. And
it's now been paved over.
Well, exactly. A good percentage of it has now been paved over. So the decision behind that of how we sort, and then the green belt is now coming up for review, and we're going to actually look for expansion of green belt stuff like that, and then the idea of just sort of reducing urban sprawl generally, because all urban planners have now basically accepted that urban sprawl doesn't make anyone happier. People might think they want to live 2 hours away in a one bungalow house, but those 4 hour drive there and back commutes do not generally lead to happy lives. And that density is sort of where we need to be heading, and in the infilling is really where we need to understand, and protecting sort of our rich agricultural land outside is so important. And I think this conversation, that's the way she frames it as Ontario's oil sands, is fascinating because, A, it is an economic driver, and it's a massive business we need to actually fight or engage with. Maybe fight is the wrong word, but engage with and discuss how best it can sort of be used to support, A, our society, but also, B, not over carbon emissions. But at the same time, it also is something that we need to control. And keep it in check to some extent, and to make sure that we're actually thinking of the future, not just sort of, you know, the current way we do things is that we, you know, small towns are funding improvements at Denton Core by expanding, and that's this, you know, it's this constant expansion model we see almost everywhere in society that is now expanded also to the fact that, you know, small towns are now have the land footprint of just of unreasonable size because everyone wants the one bungalow houses.
Yeah. Well, and also, you know, lots of people want to live outside the city, but they don't want to give up any of the things they get from living in a city. It's the I want to have it all sort of mentality. And we, you know, at some level, we just have to get used to the fact that just because you can technically pay for something doesn't mean you can have it. There mm-hmm. have to be limits.
Yeah.
We have to have some confines. And so one of the things that I thought was really interesting on this, and we'll go to MA for comment on this as well in a second, but was, you know, there was a unique thing because I haven't heard a lot of people put the infrastructure sort of context in that. That was a very headline grabby statement. But the sentiment is not a new one. I think what's really new here is that somebody who's just been put in a position where they actually have an ability directly out to influence the solution of this problem saying something like that is definitely new. Mm-hmm. And that's why I was sort of like, did Hudak not like know what did like was yeah. he just like really sleepy that morning? Like I don't know. I feel like I'd like to give him more of a benefit of the doubt, but I've just been trained really well not to. I don't know, but I mean, if she's coming in, you know, with some really with a really specific, and this is one of the things that heartened me. She's coming in with a really specific to-do list.
Yeah.
And it's not about, you know, sort of generalities around we need to sort of incorporate environmental values and blah, 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 blah. It's, oh, great. Here's a hit list and here's what I'm going to do. And by the way, here's a bunch of ways we can solve it. And here's why the solutions that have been presented in the past suck. So watch me.
Yeah.
And I love it. I so love it. So she's great. Emma, do you have anything you want to add on that?
Only, I couldn't have said it better, Darren, but only that, you know, we've been talking about not just being critical, but being solution focused. And if she can bring that, that will be wonderful. I mean, a lot of these issues relate to having affordable housing near transit, yeah. near public transit. And those are very big challenges that are related to land use, of course. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. The transit conversation is also highlighted in the article, the difficulty matching transit with agriculture. You know, we need expansive GO transit to ensure or the high speed, you know, some sort of rail transit to get people where they need to go. But if you're, you know, plowing up a bunch of arable land, you have some difficulties. And there's always that sort of, where can we find that balance? Life's a balance, people. Life's a balance.
Well, and it comes back to this thing, like, it's – and I guess it's just because, you know, people like us are more trained to think at a global level. But it's not a difference of opinion. It's that you have to now do it. We have global mm-hmm. level impact. So if you're not thinking globally to address problems, then you're just being an idiot. Like, it's that's just wrong. That's not an objective opinion or that's not a subjective opinion thing. You're just doing it wrong. But, like, one of the things people say is, you know, well, it's like, oh, well – so where are we going to grow food? I'd be like, no, you don't understand. There's a global food system. We'll have people, you know, in Africa grow our food or wildflowers or whatever else we need. I'd be like, oh, well, how is their land? Well, it's because of the climate change conditions and the pre-existing conditions, whatever. It's not nearly as good as our soil.